This is Art Moves. Art Moves is a series of curated conversations at the intersection of art, innovation, and social justice.
Each week, we'll be talking with the innovative thinkers and doers who are forging new ground in the creative arts or redefining what it means to be creative.
I'm Tony Williams.
And I'm Eli Kaslansky.
And we're your host for Art Moves. Today, we'll be talking with Frances Brunett, and she is the 12th president of Pratt Institute. To our listeners, this lady is truly fascinating. But I want to start with a really fun story. And that is, Frances, when I went on YouTube, I was able to really dig into your love of dance and how it seemed as though, I think you said you were enamored by dance. And I was enamored by watching these dancers on scaffolding in spandex. Could you talk to us about some of your research with dance?
Well, I have to go way back.
That's okay.
So I grew up in a working-class neighborhood in Montreal, and the neighborhood was Eastern Europeans, Haitians, Moroccans, Tunisians. We all hung out in a place called Neighborhood House, which was a stripped-down place over a grocery store that had a jukebox, a ping-pong table, and a pool table. Apparently, it came out of the Y, and it was set up for children of immigrants who were considered delinquents.
Oh, okay.
So they were worried about us, that our parents were working. We were let loose in the streets at a young age because many of our parents as immigrants had come from, again, very, very deleterious situations, including my own family. I'm a child of Holocaust survivor. And so Montreal streets were safe, right? Go out and play. Get out of the house. Go play. I think that perhaps the officials didn't think our playing in the streets was needed to be more calibrated. In any case, Neighborhood House was a place that we hung out, and dance was our common language. So we would have a jukebox. We would have all the, you know, current music. We had older siblings who would go down to New York, find out what the cool dances were,
and
we would learn
Montreal, huh?
And bring them back. And so I would say that I'm a very skilled dancer, but I'm absolutely not a trained dancer.
But you're skilled. That's all that matters.
So I'm very comfortable dancing. I would just say that. And I'll dance anywhere in any place. What that meant is as I moved into the academy and I became a faculty member and we were designing, I'm an architect and an engineer, and I was teaching architecture students how to design space. And I realized they knew how to design it in little models, but they didn't understand what their bodies could do in that space. So we decided to build large scale installations so that they could inhabit the space themselves. And then we did some in some abandoned storefronts in Troy, New York. I was teaching at RPI, Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, upstate New York. And the abandoned storefronts, now dancers went by and said, hey, could we play in there? Skateboarders came. Can we play in there? And so that's actually how these emergent dance presentations occurred. And then somebody said to me, this is my student work, and somebody said to me, well, Frances, don't you want to design an installation? Actually, no. That's my student work. That's really good. And in any case, what happened was I always looked for the best dance companies in whatever town I was in. In Troy, it was the Ellen Sinopoli Dance Company. We did this installation. The first one was Beating a Path, which was how do you design a space that evolves over time? So if you think about a space that you would occupy, let's say, what does beating a path mean? You're in the forest and there's all this over, you know, growth. You keep walking through it and you beat a path. But if you don't walk through it or thousands of people are not there, it closes up again. Could we design space that accommodates movement like that? That when you're not there, it is actually, it's not there in some ways.
Would you say that's common or uncommon for architects to consider that? Because most of them are obviously not dancers.
I think that I was working with an extraordinary faculty member, Ken Warner, who was always looking at space in movement. What does that mean? Can space move? Can you occupy space that actually transforms with the way that you, when you're in it?
That's interesting.
Yeah, it's like a dynamic building, right?
Right. But it doesn't have, does the building actually have to move, or do you move? So that if you're sitting at this table, if you're under the table, you have a kind of cave. And if you stood up, you're now in this bigger space. So how do you actually modify, you know, work in that kind of arena? So that's really what happened. We designed these spatial, you know, places, space places. And action artists said, can we do something in it? And one thing led to another. And these were spaces that were developed over time. So Spill Out, the project that you were talking to me about earlier, was 40 feet long, you know, about 18 feet high, 2 feet wide. And we covered basically a scaffolding with, I don't know, 10,000 elastic bands.
That's kind of different. I mean, where does that come from? You know, that.
Yeah. Well, elastic moves.
Right.
Right. And the opportunity to actually engage your body.
So
it was like a vertical trampoline, two sets of a vertical trampoline. But the most interesting thing is if I moved on that vertical trampoline and you're at the other end, you're going to move because I am pushing this spandex.
So the interconnection.
So the walls are flexible, right?
So that became a thesis for my whole life, by the way, that there's no way that if I'm on that space and you're on that space and you move, I will feel it. So that the opportunity to actually think collaboratively in through our bodies became critical.
That's pretty spiritual, too, because, you know, there's that dynamic of us all being one spirit, of the same spirit, but different expressions of that, which is somewhat similar to what you're saying right there. How interesting. I never would have, Eli, would you have thought of putting elastic bands around a scaffold?
No, but it's hard to say. No, probably not. But the thing is that the question that comes to mind, actually, I love this idea, but especially the fact that it's a vertical trampoline, that's kind of cool. But the question that does come to mind is that you say it also has influenced what you're doing now as the president of Pratt. I mean, it must show up some ways.
So I'll tell you how it shows up. Mm-hmm. The next dance project was actually something called Don't Leave Me. I often...
Oh, interesting.
And what it was again, by picking the best dance company, whatever city I was in, this time I was in Eugene, Oregon. I'm the Dean of Architecture and Allied Arts. And the best company was a company called Danceability, which was a mixed abilities dance company. The lead dancer had cerebral palsy. Another dancer had, at 11 years old, had cancer. And so she had her hip and one leg surgically removed. She was in her 60s. She could fold up into a box, you know, that would fit under a regular dining room chair. Most of us cannot fold up like that. I mean, maybe, you know, your last, if you, Joe could because he does yoga. I mean,
you
really have to be able to move your body. We designed an entire project around her body and the ability that she could actually take up so much space. And we developed these little frames that were 2x2x2, you know, basically imagine boxes that are only the edges, you know, there's basically wood, tiny, tiny beams that are holding this together. And we stacked them all up like blocks and you could go in and out through them, but nothing attached them. They were all loose. The only thing that held them together was your grip.
Wow.
So as I'm moving, you could feel if somebody released one of them, you could feel that this set of boxes would fall over. Don't leave me, because somebody went to the top. We all left, and the whole entire wall
exercise.
Came down.
Oh goodness!
So please don't leave me. What that was about was that in any organization, in any structure, you want to feel the force of the other people holding this thing together, and then when you release something. Something else has to give. Somebody else has to hold it together. So the collective.
That's a real teamwork.
Absolutely.
Teamwork. Right.
And building the team, mm-hmm. building trust, building transparency, building an opportunity to work together that if somebody is missing, the project is not going to thrive.
Is that the secret sauce of your leadership model in terms of how you lead?
In any organization, in any structure, you want to feel the force of the other people holding this thing together. And then when you release something, something else has to give. Somebody else has to hold it together. So building the team, building trust, building transparency, building an opportunity to work together that if somebody is missing, the project is not going to thrive. So that has been a foundational element of even the way I think about leadership or collaboration is, what's your voice? What's your voice? How do you hold it together? And your grip may be very differently manifest than my grip, but how do we make that all work as a whole?
Well, I think it's also especially important in a university, which has a lot of verticals to it, and it's almost like independent states like, you know, Italy before Garibaldi, you know.
But I would say it was the European Union now. under its best scenario. I think the secret sauce, I don't think, obviously there's no singular sauce, right? But I do think that one of the elements that I always look at is, if you imagine a family, in every member of your family has something extraordinary. Now, there may be other things that they whine, they're self-involved, they don't listen to you. That's noise. All of that is noise. What is it that's extraordinary about them? And the job of a leader or a manager is to bring out that extraordinary capacity and really see everything else as noise. So I would say that getting to that place, when you go back to the spiritual, people will say that that is something about having what can you change the framework so that everybody's excellence is present all the time.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking to Frances Brunette, the president of Pratt Institute, about holding it together as a leader of teams. You have been a lot of firsts, and now you are the first female president of Pratt Institute. Wondering how you have managed in this quote-unquote man's world. That is shifting. It is shifting. But how, coming through this, you know, how did that work for you?
It's really interesting because I think I didn't pay attention to that at all. Okay. And you'll hear this, I think, from a lot of women now of my generation who will say we didn't notice it, right? We were just blowing through this. And I was in engineering and I was in architecture. I didn't see it. I didn't pay attention to it. I probably had other issues that were even more present. Being working class in the academy is there are very few working class academics. Statistically, there are probably less working class academics than there are women in the academy. Pratt, of course, I will say, is an extraordinarily generous place in many ways, both intellectually and with respect to compassion. So maybe it is because it is an art place. People are always digging deep into their work, and that generosity is, and it's hard work. They're rigorous. They spend enormous amount of time on it, and there has to be a level of patience and openness to receive it. So maybe, you know, generosity begets generosity, and that's what we have in a place like Pratt. So I've never felt that as a woman there was any kind of differentiation. Mm-hmm. And from my experience, certainly not at a place like Pratt. And I have to say, I was at two engineering institutions before Pratt. I was at Rensselaer Polytechnic Institute, primarily an engineering science institution. And I was at Illinois Institute of Technology as a provost, which is primarily an engineering institution. I didn't see it. I hear about it a lot. And then my job is to open those concerns and, you know, be able to build a landscape where people feel supported and heard so that there isn't a concern, did you have to make it in a man's world? And again, Pratt is dominated by women. 70% of our students are female, or identify female, I will say. And so I think that's also an interesting place to be. But the academy generally is a very open and supportive place.
So if you look at the landscape of the school, and I know in a convergence economy, it's important to make these horizontal connections for things like, you know, Pratt had, for example, exhibit design, and it also has, you know, urban planning and has art and architecture. So just it'd be great to hear you talk a little bit about what kind of connectivities you're doing across those schools and programs that are, say, not necessarily connected to one school or another.
So I think it's interesting that you asked that question because, of course, they hired me because I was, quote unquote, an interdisciplinarian. And when I started to do it, it was like, don't do that. You'll never get tenure. You'll never have they're not going to keep you because it's too, it's not centered on an expert level of discipline. Pratt actually has multiple ways of dealing with this. So first of all, almost every single discipline, the students come in through foundation. Foundation is all disciplines, learning fundamental sort of theoretical precepts around art, color, form. And so you could be a film major, photography major, ceramics major, fashion major. you're coming together. So you're opening, you know, gambit at Pratt, except if you're in architecture. don't ever ask.
Okay, I'm going to delete that one. Nobody's
Well, in any case, is actually you're meeting, but more importantly, not only learning that base of the things that traverse all domains in art and design, you're meeting students and friends who for lifetimes, so if you're in film, you now have actors that will, you know, students in other disciplines who will work with you.
Curating a network.
Right. Mm-hmm. You have narrators, you have choreographers, you have extraordinary amazing creatives coming together. So that's the very base. You walk in the door, and interestingly enough, I will say, even metaphorically, it's beautiful. The main building, which was the first building that was built on campus, is where my office is on the sort of second floor. There's a terrace floor, we'll say. And above me is foundation.
Is that Memorial Hall? Is that?
It's actually called Main Building. Memorial Hall is the next one over.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
So I think that's remarkable that the president is sitting underneath all of these young people that are building the foundation of the school.
Well, interesting.
But then we have interdisciplinary programs across. Students can have an interdisciplinary minor. They can. We have interdisciplinary research hubs for the students to join in. We so there are all of these interpenetrating opportunities for the students to do either deliberately through their curriculum, but of course they can do it. They all do it in the way that they make their art. They bring in other people. I have somebody who's better in technology and somebody who can, you know, bring in animation, but they're a ceramicist. So that happens just because they're living near each other or they met foundation.
But the school also has designed to do that kind of thing.
We also have, it's quite deliberate to
build
that.
I understand.
Yeah, yeah.
But this is the contribution in a lot of ways that you've made to the school.
Well, foundation existed over 100 years.
But there's other areas in which you can create those horizons.
And I think it's something that when the leader is saying this is a good thing,
right. People
feel confident that they're
more
supported.
Comfortable. Exactly.
And more interdisciplinary offerings start to take root.
Now, what about the richness of the community that surrounds Pratt? We're talking about interconnectivity within. How does it look on the outside?
So it's so fascinating. So I'm a big bridge builder. This is, you know, probably what I have been doing all my life. And we sit in an extraordinarily rich community, right? I mean, we've got Myrtle Avenue and DeKalb, and we've got the Navy Yard. And I actually now, my new, you have to say this with me, it's Downtown Dumbo Navy Yard Pratt.
Downtown Dumbo Navy Yard Pratt.
Downtown Dumbo Navy Yard Pratt. And it is a 1.3 by 0.5 mile rectangle. Mm-hmm. And that's what we sit. And in it is unbelievable.
It's incredible.
If we just think about
saturated.
The academies that are there, there's Pratt, there's St. Joe's, there's NYU and Engineering School, St. Francis is there. I mean,
right. We're
all, and
New
we're
York
all
City
friends.
Tech. Right.
New
Absolutely.
York City Tech. We've got Brooklyn College and the Navy Yard.
Steiner Studios.
And we're, Steiner Studios. Yes. And we're all kind of connected in the Navy Yard. We actually have an anchor there. We've had robotics there for years. We teach students, you know, STEM stuff in the Navy Yard. And of course, you probably know, we've been running a K-12 program for over 100 years at Pratt.
I was in that, by the way.
You were in
that
it?
That Saturday, yeah.
The K-12.
Yeah, there's a
Saturday art program.
Right. Saturday arts program.
And now we have, you know, 500 students a year.
Yeah, I remember it.
Now, it was much smaller, but we have Pratt Scholars. We have, you know, students from all over this area, from NYCHA, from the community coming. We have something, you know, we have the Scholars program, which is completely supported. These students, we build their portfolios in various disciplines. We help them with their college essays. We help them basically go to college, and all of them are college bound. This year, we were lucky enough that of the 16 graduates in this year, there are 50 in 10, 11, and 12. And of the 16, 8 are coming to Pratt. That's the highest number we ever get because they get, they're going to Yale. They're going to Syracuse. So that's very exciting. And students can apply from the local community and come be part of it. So, again, some of it fully supportive, some of it you know, partially supported.
You're listening to Art Moves on WNYE 91.5 FM. We're talking to Frances Brunette, the president of Pratt Institute. Can you share your intentional strategy to diversify your student body?
Absolutely. As you can imagine, it's probably something pretty significant to me. I grew up in a working class family. My father was a laborer all his life, and there is no way I could have gone to college without support. And even in Montreal, where college is, compared to an American education, almost free, my parents expected me to earn
but
money.
But they valued an education, though, I would imagine, they even valued you an and your brother, because your brother is also doing phenomenally well.
He is a college professor as well, my brother. I don't know how that happened, because my parents didn't go to school. My father finished in second grade, and my mother didn't finish eighth grade. But it was education was valued. It was valued in our community. But going to school was going to – and as a female – it was more important for me to get married, as you can imagine, but that wasn't, you know, that was certainly not a priority in my game. But going back to scholarships, support, bringing in students, we want, as our new enrollment vice president for enrollment management has said in his interview, we want to be the best place for makers, for anybody.
For makers.
Anybody who's a maker. You need to come to us. Pratt is that place for you. And so how do we do that? Well, last year we generated 25 full wraparound scholarships.
Oh, wow.
Wraparound, room, board, tuition. These came from Balenciaga supported two students, full wraparound. Catherine and Kenneth Chenault supported three architecture students, wraparound. And through the president's portfolio, we started 20 Wallace Augustus Rayfield scholarships for students who were coming from diverse backgrounds. So all 25. Is 25 enough? I need 2,500.
Yes,
I mean,
right.
So
right,
it's a drop in the bucket, but this is the beginning of how do we open this up. Now, there are many ways to open up supportive possibilities. One is scholarship. The other is bringing cohorts in that will support each other. The other is, can you go to school for an associate's degree, certificates, continue education, K through 12, other possibilities for other kinds of communities and coming in a different way. And so again, one of the great opportunities with technology is opening up those seams for people who couldn't commit 4 years at a time to go to school. So that's a very interesting thing that's happening in our continuing and professional programs. How do we do that? The other, I think, is, so what if you spend a lot of money to come to Pratt?
Right. What about
what happens afterwards?
You know what? You were reading my mind, because I was like, that's the segue question. Right. How do you get
so
the payback?
So I'm going to give you
the return on your investment.
Return on investment. So return on investment has multiple ways to look at it. If you really want a great return on your investment, you might want to think about computer science, right? Immediately. Or you might want to go work for finance right. And go into, you know, do, you know, financial technology. But I will tell you about our students is that when they, this is a life they love, right? Forever. And they have different ways of exploring. But we have a very robust career services program, incredibly robust. In 2019, and we just got the data about 3 weeks ago, of all of our students, and I think we had something like a 70 to 75% return rate of people, 99% have been employed in their fields or adjacent to their fields. Now,
you said 99%.
Of our graduates.
That has to be surface.
That is
yes.
Crazy number. Yes. Now, somebody, of course, graduating, going to Goldman Sachs is going to say to me, so you're saying they're a barista in a gallery? Is that adjacent? And something that I have heard many, many times is artists, architects, designers, you've got to find a way to do your work, your creative work. And there may be some times where you don't have 24 hours in a day to do your creative work because you're doing something else that's bringing in revenue for you to do that work. But you're in a place that where there's extraordinary creative energy and you're making connections. I have a great friend who is an incredible artist and was doing, she was a model maker for a big architecture firm. And what happened there was not only was she doing her art and understanding, and her art actually became pretty architectural, is that she made connections as a 20-year-old to an architecture community that ultimately would commission her in her later years. So it's also about the relationships you built, right? And I will say that every piece of my work has been about relationship building. People who are sitting now in my president's task force are people I knew as a 20-year-old who themselves became leaders. Haven't been in contact with them for 30 years, but their work was also based in this creative arena. And how do we come back to that?
It's funny how we grow together.
No, I always thought that our schools and architecture schools should have a technology transfer program. The reason I asked is because I was on a board for Columbia University Center of Advanced Technology. I could see the value for it. Could you speak a little bit about it? Is something like that idea appeal to you? Do you see a role for it in some place like Pratt?
So tech transfer is always fascinating to me. It, for a lot of reasons. We have a minor in entrepreneurship, number one, which is pretty new, started just a couple of years ago. We do have this research yard, which is focused on technologies. And not only that, I'll just tell you today, again, I was looking at student projects, and there was a student who designed an entire array of these attachments, very, very simple attachments that could go onto any normative thing from a spatula to a spoon for people who might be missing their hands. They're prosthetic attachments, and they are so simple that I've been looking at this and going, oh, my God, we've got to patent it immediately. I can't believe we stuck this on. I have all these board members looking at it. And before you know it, that technology transfers out of our hands. So, but it is very hard, unless you're like, you know, University of Florida and Gatorade, which emerged out of a University of Florida research project. It's hard, right, to that technology transfer. We're seeing more and more of it, you know, from the Media Lab at MIT or Stanford, Caltech. You see it in technology schools, huge investment into that research that will ultimately generate some phenomenal work. Our students really want to make a difference in the world. That's what they're thinking. Our job is to make a difference and also make sure that they can support themselves, right? So if they're doing great innovation, how do we build a rubric for that innovation to both engage the world? We have, you know, we have people, Tucker Weimeister, who is a graduate of industrial design. He designed all those OXO grips, things that really made our lives much, much easier.
Absolutely. And in closing, you mentioned in something that I was reading or listening to that you wanted to be a leader of a think tank. Do you want to just close us with the think tank that you're leading?
Well, you know, of course, what is a university but
exactly.
A think tank? It's and I've been incredibly fortunate that when I said that at 17, what do I want to be? I want to be the head of a think tank because probably the greatest gift or my superpower is that I can recognize genius in other people and be able to knit them together in some way that makes an incredible quilt. Sorry for mixing metaphors here.
That is wonderful. And you're a mentor too. I'm just hearing it in the way that you're speaking. This has been a fascinating conversation. So glad you're at the helm of Pratt Institute. And thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for the very provocative questions.
Art Moves is co-produced by Brick Arts Media and pre-recorded at Brick Studio in downtown Brooklyn.
This has been Art Moves with your hosts, Tony Williams and Eli Kozlansky. Find some art that moves you and share it with someone.